Welcome to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report. The Nooshigak has apportionment, the run is picking up there, and the wood run is doing pretty well, too. Down on the Alaska Peninsula, however, the early chignik run is extremely weak for the third June in a row. It's Friday, June 19th. I'm your host, Izzy Ross. Coming up tonight, today is Juneteenth, a holiday also known as Emancipation Day. We talked to a Bristol Bay historian about Black history and racism in Alaska.
Alaska canneries were places of discrimination, racism, and then later when women come onto the scene, sexism. They're also sites where you see change occur too.
The Chignik's early run is off to an extremely low start for the third year in a row. We hear how things are looking at the Chignik Weir.
So we are about 110,000 fish, 115,000 fish behind our minimum objective. We're comparable to 2018 and 19 as of right now. We are classifying the run as a weak run.
The Army Corps of Engineers introduced an alternative transportation route for the proposed Pebble Mine as it nears submission of the final environmental impact statement this summer. But regional entities are not happy with the change.
We are the subsurface landowner. Under all of the transportation alternatives, we have surface acreage over a couple of allotments that we have purchased that are specifically along the northern route. And yes, we've objected all along.
Those conversations and more on the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report.
The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is brought to you by the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association. Ensuring long-term growth is the world's greatest salmon fishery through investment in Bristol Bay science, infrastructure, marketing, and quality. The Bristol Bay RSDA, we're on board with you.
First, we're going to take a look at the numbers this evening. There are still no daily run summaries, but the Nooshigak has reached apportionment. The crew filled the last strata yesterday morning. There are four strata, inshore, offshore, and on either side of the river. In order to apportion fish counts from the Nooshigak sonar counter, biologists have to catch at least five fish in each of the strata. From those catches, they can extrapolate how many of each species of salmon are making it upriver. The daily king count yesterday was 5,100 for a total of 9,200 so far this season. The tower counted 11,500 sockeye. That total is now up to 29,500. And the daily count for chum was 2,400 for a total of 4,800. The Wood River has counted 990 fish so far this morning. Yesterday, the tower counted a total of 7,000 fish for a cumulative total of 14,000 fish so far this season. The Chignik Weir count yesterday was 819, with 156 more as of noon today. The total escapement for 2020 so far is 12,860 fish. That's almost 35,000 fish less than this time last year, but about 1,000 fish more than this time in 2018. In 2017, almost 151,000 fish had escaped by this point in the season, putting this year about 138,000 behind 2017. We'll have more on the situation over in Chignik a little later in the show. On the South Peninsula, the pink harvest has topped 1 million at 1,073,294. The sockeye harvest is at 150,000. Chinook are at 1,600. The coho catch remains at 226. And chum are at 255,500. The Port Muller test fishery didn't fish yesterday due to rough weather. Today is looking better, and the crew hopes to get a good sample number from stations. Technician Michael Link said in an email update, the Ocean Cat is going to leave Port Muller in the next couple hours and run north into this mess. It should arrive at Station 20 about 13 to 14 hours after it departs. From there, it will begin to fish southbound if conditions are fishable. The fishing vessel Americanus, which is the backup to the Pandalus, left False Pass yesterday morning. It planned to head north this morning to fish outbound from Station 2, and the two vessels will meet mid-transect, those two vessels being Ocean Cat and Americanus. The timing of the first stock composition estimates of 2020 will depend on several factors, including how successful and productive fishing is today. Port Muller will provide more information about any possibilities in this evening's update. Link says that weather usually affects the test fishing operations a few days every season, and he adds that the longer range forecast looks encouraging. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with you here on the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report in a moment.
Support for KDLG and the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report comes from Hatton Marine in Ballard, Washington, supporting and servicing the Bristol Bay Fishery for the last 20 years. Parts and service requests online at hattonmarine.com or 888-283-5639.
The state announced 7 new COVID-19 cases in the Bristol Bay, Lake, and Peninsula region today. All were out-of-state seafood workers. That brings the number of cases associated with the region up to 19. In an update, Chamai Director Mary Swain clarified that 3 of the cases were in the Bristol Bay Borough and were reported on June 16th. Swain wrote that all 3 of the new cases had tested negative for COVID-19 before traveling to Alaska and all are asymptomatic. One of the positive cases was a roommate of a previous positive case. The Chamai Clinic in Naknek also asked fishermen to consider getting a test before heading out on the water. The Leader Creek Clinic is now open Wednesday through Sunday, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. People can call to set up an appointment at 907-246-4064, and they can call the Chamai Clinic as well, 246-6155. 155 years ago today, the last enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, learned they were free, a full 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. In honor of Juneteenth this year, KDLG's Sage Smiley spoke with a local historian about the history of Black Americans and racism in the state of Alaska and here in Bristol Bay.
Since the 19th of June, 1865, what's come to be known as Juneteenth, the holiday has spread through communities in the United States as a day celebrating the belated liberation of Black people in America, as well as a time to reflect on continued inequity. This year, the holiday is receiving heightened attention amidst the nationwide protests against racist police brutality and inequality.
I think Alaskans like to think that we are different than the lower 48, but the reason why Alaska Studies is mandatory in schools is because of racist attacks on Alaska Native people in the late part of the 20th century.
That's Katie Ringsmith, the historian and director of the NN Cannery History Project.
Racism absolutely still exists. And, you know, you see the kind of systematic racism, even in just how we speak about rural versus urban. However, it's also important to recognize that Alaska is going to pass an anti-discrimination act in the 1940s, 10 years before Brown v. Board of Education.
Of course, the legislature initially failed to pass an anti-discrimination bill in 1943. Elizabeth Paradovich, a Tlingit leader, championed another version of the bill 2 years later in 1945. Bristol Bay's salmon industry in the 1800s was predominantly Alaska Native and white. Most of the cannery workers were Chinese until the Chinese Exclusion Act in the late 1800s, when Chinese people's ability to work in the U.S. was severely restricted.
So African American story is really about the power of African Americans' purchase of canned salmon.
Ringsmith says that the American South was a large market for Alaska canned salmon. That marketing was overtly racist. Some salmon labels even referenced slavery. And there were also more insidious forms of racism.
You know, in those days, they kind of put the bad cans off to the side. And those were sold in markets in, you know, African-American communities. So the lesser brands, the brands that were not considered high-end, were made and targeted to the African-American communities. And we're talking, this is back in the turn of the century.
Ringsmith says the numbers of Black workers in Bristol Bay canneries was very low.
But nevertheless, there's a photograph of a cannery crew, which I think is Diamond J, if I'm correct. And you look at the faces of the crew, and this is probably the early 1930s when this photo was taken. And it is a multicultural story. Alaska canneries were places of discrimination, racism, and then later when women come onto the scene, sexism. They're also sites where you see change occur too.
Ringsmith says that minority communities in the canneries levied lawsuits that forced change in the discriminatory practices of the plants in the 1970s. In other areas of Alaska during the late 1940s, contributions of Black Americans in the military to the Alcan Highway helped convince President Truman to integrate the troops, even as restrictive covenants in some Alaska cities barred Black people from purchasing homes in certain areas. Ringsmith ultimately sees historical projects like the NN Cannery Project as a way for people to learn about Alaska's history of diversity and growth.
And again, you have these, you know, places, you know, our military bases. We have neighborhoods that are some of the most diverse in the nation. We have industries that, you know, like the fishing industry, that's multinational, that transnational, if you will. Even the salmon, you know, come from all over the world. So how can we use that, you know, to empower ourselves? And I think that's really the question. And that's, at the end of the day, what the NN Cannery Project hopes to do.
Alaska State Senator L.V. Gray Jackson announced today that she will propose legislation next year to designate the 19th of June as a state Juneteenth holiday. Alaska currently designates the third Saturday in June as Juneteenth. Senator Gray Jackson said, quote, "Establishing Juneteenth as an official day of recognition in Alaska not only acknowledges the wrongful enslavement of African Americans, but also recognizes there is still a lot of work that needs to be done in this country to establish equity for all Americans." In Dillingham, I'm Sage Smiley.
This spring, not many fishermen participated in the Togiak herring fishery. A total of 3 vessels were part of the harvest this year due to the pandemic, and there was only one processor. Any information regarding the herring harvest is confidential because only one processor was buying fish. That processor was Icicle Seafoods. Area management biologist Tim Sands says this season was especially unusual.
It was kind of a strange year, although, you know, it seems like every year is a little bit different and strange in some way. It was strange the way the fish entered the district. What was really strange was how fast the fish size went down. You know, typically our harvest will come in and the first couple days will be 400 plus gram fish. And this year we started at well below 400 grams and we went down to much smaller fish, below 250 grams by the end. And typically we don't see that.
Weather for the herring season was generally good and didn't hamper fishing, and the fishery continued until fishermen ended participation on May 16th. For more on herring, I caught up with gill netter Frank Woods. How was the season for you?
Well, it was early. It was a mediocre season, seemed like. It was lonely. There was only a boat over there for about 10 days on the gill net side. A lot of fish, a lot of small fish, a lot of mixed fish. And at the end, there were a lot of spawn out. So that was interesting. This kind of everything changed in the world, but it was a lot different with the fish. Never seen it. So it's a small bag, and there was no spawn where they traditionally spawn, let's put it that way.
Huh. So they usually spawn in a certain area, and that didn't happen this time?
I'm pretty sure they spawned in the deep water, and they weren't spawning in traditional areas of Eagle Bay, Kalukuk Bluff, Medervik. Those spawn, but not just spot spawn. The 2 weeks I was over there, and the fish were really small the whole season of mixed fish. They came in early, and they came in mixed.
This year was not as early as the past couple years. What makes you say that it was early?
Compared to traditionally how fish, or at least herring in the past, have come in, big fish come in early and then wiping up. The younger age class come in later in the season and then they're wiping up a dip and they spawn. We had decent weather, so there's no reason they couldn't spawn on the beach, but they just didn't spawn on the beach, or at least in the traditional areas they normally do. And it was not that how you call it traditional herring season. It's everything changed.
We talked about the market back in December and the market for herring, and especially for gill netters, you know, it can be tough. How was the season for you financially?
Don't know yet. Fish haven't gotten sold. There's, the herring is a kind of a hard sell commodity, and there's one traditional market, and that's for the sackerel. And I size my gear for the roll percentage, and, you know, we can't deliver anything less than 10%. They don't want them anyway. And then, you know, Sitka Sound never kicked off, so there's no flood of market herring on the market before we got it. And you know, they want certain size. Anything below 300 is questionable. Every delivery casting size, you know, I could pick and choose with my size of gear, but, you know, the whole year was mixed bag of small fish, sound like, for the seiners, and it was that started right from the beginning. When I got there, there was 10 miles of ice in front of Kluka and Right Hand Point coming from Picnic Beach, and water was cold. You know, the water temperature really didn't play a part in them. I don't know what happened, but, things were definitely different. I mean, even the seiners that seen for 30 years, they said everything changed, and it was a lot different than expected, even worse than when it's early. Mm-hmm. Even more mixed up than it was years past, I could put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Are you fishing for salmon?
Yeah, I'm getting ready. We're just about ready.
Got it. How has, I mean, you know, preparations for this season have been complex and difficult. How is preparing for the season for you?
You know, I'm just lucky to go fishing to get out of all the COVID stuff. But, you know, it's a challenge. It's a good challenge that we stay safe and also, you know, keep everyone in our crew and the community and family safe. But, yeah, you just got to be conscious and to be aware. But it's a challenge getting stuff we need sometimes, and you got to prepare. I just detune everything just to slow down and get through this year. It'd be what we all want to do.
Any other thoughts before we say bye?
Yeah, I wish everybody a successful and safe salmon season. And, you know, it's pretty serious and scary times right now. So I appreciate it.
That was Gilnetter Frank Woods. Chignik's Sockeye Run is off to a slow start this season. The latest escapement numbers as of June 19th at noon are now up to 12,860. Biologists aren't expecting any commercial openers, at least for the first run. Here's Ross Rennick, the Chignik Area Management Biologist.
Compared to the last 2 years, we're comparable to 2018 and 19 as of right now. We are classifying the run as a weak run. Our escapement goals are currently for today, June 18th, our minimum escapement would be 128,000 sockeye. So we are about 110,000 fish, 115,000 fish behind our minimum objective, and the early run is classified as weak.
The Chignik sockeye runs dropped to record lows in 2018 when just under 540,000 sockeye returned and there were no commercial openers. In 2019, it was only moderately better. Rennick doesn't expect any commercial openers during the first run due to low escapement. The late run in July could be a more robust normal return, but Rennick says it's too early to tell.
So in Chignik, we do have two stocks. We have the early run stock and our late run stock. As of right now, we don't have any projected commercial openings on sockeye because of the weak escapement. Our late run stock typically starts to show up in early July, peaks in late July, and it's too early to evaluate whether that run, what the run strength is of that late run as of right now, because we just don't see enough of those fish. Moving forward, no commercial openings on early run sockeye salmon are projected. Late run is still to be determined.
Rennick says they will continue to monitor the run and open fishing if it's strong enough.
For this season, right now, we're just going to keep evaluating. We do have a few biological indicators that the run is a little bit late, but it's still weak in terms of the early run. And the plan going forward is what we typically do is when we meet interim escapement objectives, open the fishery when we have surplus harvest surplus fish to harvest. We'll just evaluate the late run. You know, we do have forecasts that come out, so we kind of use those as a guideline, but we really need to evaluate fish and make sure we meet escapement goals before we allow any kind of fishing. So the plan essentially moving forward is just to evaluate the run strength and allow commercial opportunity when it's available.
And we'll continue to keep an eye on the situation over in the Chignik's. The Army Corps of Engineers plans to release its final environmental review of the proposed Pebble Mine later this summer. Last month, the Corps changed which transportation corridor it recommends. The route cuts through land owned by several Bristol Bay entities that refused to grant Pebble access to their properties. KDLG's Tyler Thompson looks at what the route could mean for the final environmental review.
Known as the Northern Route, the transportation corridor is an 82-mile road along Lake Iliamna. Trucks would use it to move copper and gold from the mine site in the north and drive along the lake to Diamond Point Port, where it would then be shipped off. A pipeline transporting minerals would run parallel with the road. The Army Corps of Engineers announced last month that the northern route was its preferred alternative for the final environmental review. Pebble's southern route was previously the preferred alternative. It would have used a ferry system to carry minerals across Lake Iliamna. When Senator Lisa Murkowski heard the news, she called the change unsettling.
And that's probably a mild word for many who we heard from, because it was a new route in the sense that it was a change after completion of the EIS. I know it may sound old, but I mean it. If this project can't meet the high bar that it needs to meet, then it should not be allowed to move forward.
The northern route was identified by the Environmental Protection Agency as the least environmentally damaging practical alternative, also known as LEDPA, but it would still permanently impact the area's wetlands. According to the EPA, the route could destroy up to 2,300 acres of wetlands and 105 miles of streams. Pebble spokesperson Mike Heatwolz says the partnership will have to overhaul its plans for compensatory mitigation or offsetting the mine's impacts to wetlands. Pebble originally proposed to make up for environmental damage by providing water and sewer upgrades around Kakanak, New Halen, and Nundalton.
One of the other process pieces that we work through here is will end up being the compensatory mitigation plan for the wetlands impacts. And obviously that changes a little bit going from the northern route to the southern route, and we'll continue to work on it.
If the mine is permitted, Pebble has to complete any compensatory mitigation before construction of the mine can begin. But there's another barrier Pebble will need to consider.
We are the subsurface landowner under all of the transportation alternatives. We have surface acreage over a couple of allotments that we have purchased that are specifically along the northern route. And yes, we've objected all along from day one to the use of either our surface or subsurface resources for the construction of the transportation corridor for this project.
That's Dan Chayette, Vice President of Lands and Resources for the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. BB&C has condemned the alternative transportation route. Chayette says they will not be granting Pebble any right-of-way access to the land.
TOP apparently doesn't believe they need our permission, and those issues will have to be addressed or litigated or worked out down the line.
The route also cuts through land owned by Iliamna Natives Limited, Pedro Bay Corporation, and Igiagig Village Council. Igiagig's council is a majority owner of Ilyaska Environmental LLC, a subsidiary that oversees Diamond Point Rock Quarry. It also plans to deny use of the property. In a letter, they say, quote, PLP's plan for Diamond Point presented in the EIS does not fit with our plans for Diamond Point and should not be considered an acceptable alternative, unquote. Iliamna Natives Limited is one of the entities that supports construction of the mine and the new route. Lisa Reimers is the CEO of Iliamna Development Corporation and is an INL board member.
We want roads. That to us is really important as part of the growth of Iliamna's to build roads.
Pebble's Vice President of Permitting, James Fugue, acknowledged in a memo that all access corridors are subject to PLP's ability to negotiate a mutually acceptable access agreement with the associated landowners. Heatwolz, the Pebble spokesperson, says that's the partnership's main focus at this time.
That's our main focus and statement right now, is that we intend to work with each of the landowners on the northern corridor and believe we'll be able to gain that access.
The Army Corps of Engineers is on schedule to submit the final EIS this summer with the northern route in mind. Another recent development from PLP is introducing a revenue-sharing incentive for residents in Bristol Bay. Pebble expects to pay at least $3 million a year in dividends that would be distributed to those who register for the program. If the mine is permitted, PLP will pay out 3% of its net annual profits each year. Reporting for KDLG in Dillingham, I'm Tyler Thompson.
Support for the Bristol Bay Fisheries Report comes from GCI, offering connectivity to communities around the state with the latest smartphones and internet packages. A full list of services and store locations at gci.com.
That's just about it for the show on this Friday night. We're going to take a look at the marine weather forecast, and we have messages to the fleet coming up right after that. Tonight, in the Bristol Bay Marine weather forecast, a west wind at 15 knots seas at 3 feet. On Saturday, southwest wind at 20 knots seas at 4 feet. And Saturday night, southeast wind, 15 knots, seas at 3 feet. In the marine weather forecast from Port Hyden to Cape Sarachef, a north wind at 15 knots tonight, seas at 4 feet. And on Saturday, a west wind at 20 knots, seas at 5 feet and rain. Saturday night, a west wind at 20 knots and seas remaining at 5 feet. In the tidal forecast at Nushagak at Clark's Point, low tide this evening at 9:09 p.m. at 1.4 feet. At the Naknek River entrance, low tide at 9:32 p.m. at negative 2.2 feet. And at the Igigik River entrance, low tide will be at 7:53 p.m. It's not that time yet. It'll be at 7:53 p.m. at negative 0.2 feet. In messages to the fleet this evening, we have a very special birthday message this evening for someone back home.
Happy birthday, Olivia May, from the crew at the Lydia Orchid, and especially your dad. We'll go out for your birthday date in August, sweetheart, and I hope your 12th birthday is super special. You're growing up too fast on me, and Soren wants to give a little message out to you too, okay? And then I got one more thing to say.
Hey, Olivia, I love you. God bless your dozen years. Looking forward to a lot more as your older brother.
And Liv, I love your beautiful smile and your ukulele skills, and I miss your tight hugs, and I hope you have a great birthday party this afternoon. Take care. Hi, y'all in Bloomsburg. Bye-bye.
In messages to the fleet, continuing on to Captain Doug Morgan from in the fishing vessel Miss Emma. Doug, I know you're still mad at Mom, but she needs to know where you hid the bunion ointment, the Oracle. The Oracle's been writing a lot, actually. Another one to Captain Doug Morgan, fishing vessel Miss Emma. Doug, the judge wants to see an actual photo of the breathalyzer installed on the boat, not just the crude drawing you sent. Otherwise, you can't fish. That's also from the Oracle. Again, just a reminder, this weekend, we're starting the Fish Report Numbers edition on Saturday and Sunday, and we'll be back full steam on Monday. If you'd like to get in touch or give some perspective, just give us a call, 842-2200. You can also send an email to fish@kdlg.org, or you can get in touch with a specific reporter. We have our contact information on the website under our stories. If you'd like to get a message out to the fleet on this show, perhaps to say hi from back home or wish them luck, send your messages to the fleet to fish@kdlg.org. The Bristol Bay Fisheries Report is made possible with the generous support of our underwriters and individual contributions from you, the fishing fleet. We appreciate it. I'm Izzy Ross. Good night, good fishing, and see you back here for the Short Numbers Report tomorrow.